Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane so big that when they finally got it under one roof, they had to build the roof around it. An airplane made almost entirely of wood. An airplane that flew for less than a minute one time, more than 75 years ago, and has never left the ground since. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the hangar where we spend a little time every day with the airplanes that earned their place in the story. And today we are standing under the biggest wooden wing anybody ever built, the Hughes H-4 Hercules. Though nobody calls it that, you know it as the Spruce Goose. Now Howard Hughes hated that name, hated it. And here's the first thing to get straight, because the name is a lie twice over. It wasn't spruce, and Howard Hughes never wanted it to be a goose. It was mostly birch, laminated birch, and Hughes considered it a serious airplane built by serious people. The reporters gave it that name to needle him. And it stuck the way a nickname sticks to a man who protests too much. But we'll come back to Hughes, because you cannot tell this airplane's story without telling his. They're the same story. Before we go any further, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friend, if there was ever a show about a thing that tells a story, it's this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let me set the scene. It's 1942. The war is on, and the Atlantic is a graveyard. German U-boats are sinking Allied ships faster than the shipyards can launch them. Men and cargo and tanks and fuel, all of it going to the bottom of the ocean before it ever reaches Europe, and a shipbuilder named Henry Kaiser, the man who was cranking out Liberty ships faster than anybody thought possible. Kaiser has an idea. If the U-boats own the water, then fly over the water, build a cargo plane so enormous it could carry a whole company of troops, or a Sherman tank, right across the Atlantic, above the reach of any submarine. It was a bold idea, and it needed somebody bold enough and rich enough and stubborn enough to build it. Enter Howard Hughes. Now here's where it gets interesting. The government put a condition on the whole thing. There was a war on, and aluminum was precious. Every pound of it was going into fighters and bombers that were flying and fighting right now. So this giant airplane, this flying cargo ship, had to be built without using critical war materials. No aluminum. Which meant, for a thing this size, you were building an airplane out of wood. Think about that for a second. The biggest airplane in the world, and they told the builders they couldn't use metal. So Hughes and his chief engineer, a brilliant man named Glenn Oedekerk, they turned to a process called Duramold, thin sheets of birch veneer, laid up in layers, glued under heat and pressure, and molded into shape. Laminated wood, furniture-grade craftsmanship on the scale of a battleship. The men who built this airplane were as much woodworkers and boat builders as they were aircraft mechanics. And the smell in that plant, I want you to imagine it would have been sawdust and hot glue and varnish. Not the burnt oil and hydraulic fluid smell of a normal hangar. This place smelled like a cabinet shop the size of a stadium. Let me give you the numbers, and I'll say them slow because they don't sound real. The wingspan. 320 feet. 320. That is longer than a football field with both end zones thrown in. To this day, this airplane has one of the longest wingspans of anything that has ever flown. It stood 5 stories tall at the tail. It was designed to haul 150,000 pounds of cargo, or 750 troops or 2 Sherman tanks, and to move all that, 8 engines. 8. Pratt and Whitney Wasp Majors, each one a monster of a radial 28 cylinders apiece, turning propellers 17 feet across. When all 8 of those lit off together, the ground shook. But here's the thing about big, ambitious wartime projects. The war doesn't wait for them. They only ordered 3 of these airplanes, then cut it to 1. And it took time. It took so much time. The wood, the molding, the sheer scale of it, and Hughes, well, Hughes was a perfectionist in the way that a man can be a perfectionist right up to the edge of madness. He obsessed over every detail. He'd order things torn out and rebuilt. He drove people to exhaustion. And the calendar kept turning. 1942 became 43. 43 became 44. And then in the summer of 1945, the war ended. Both oceans. The U-boats were gone. The threat the airplane was built to answer, it just evaporated. And the giant flying boat, the one they still hadn't finished, suddenly didn't have a job anymore. Now most airplanes, that's where the story ends. Program canceled. Funding pulled. The whole thing quietly scrapped, a footnote. But Howard Hughes did not do quiet, and he did not do footnotes, because now the government wants to know where their money went. The Senate opens hearings, 1947, and they haul Howard Hughes up in front of a committee. They call his airplane a boondoggle, a flying lumberyard. They say it'll never fly. They say he took $22 million of taxpayer money, and Hughes put in plenty of his own on top of that, and all he's got to show for it is the world's most expensive pile of birch that has never once left the water.
And Hughes, sitting in that hearing room in Washington, he takes it personally. Of course he does. And he says something to the effect of, "This airplane is my life's work. I've put the sweat of my heart into it, and if it's a failure, I'll leave this country and never come back." Then he flies back to California to prove them wrong. November 2, 1947, Long Beach Harbor. The plan, officially, was just taxi tests. They were going to run the airplane across the water, get a feel for how it handled, nothing more. There were reporters aboard, and crew, and Hughes himself was at the controls. Now picture the scene. This enormous wooden hull, big as an ocean liner, sitting low in the gray November water, 8 engines coughing and firing and settling into that deep chest-rattling roar, the props throwing spray, the whole harbor watching. He makes one taxi run, then another. And on the third run, Hughes pushes those 8 throttles forward, and the great wooden hull comes up on the step, up on the surface, the way a float plane does just before it flies, and then it flies, just barely, about 70 feet off the water. Maybe a mile, mile and a bit, down the harbor, at something like 135 miles an hour, for less than a minute. Then he set it back down gentle on the water, but it flew, in front of the reporters who came to watch it fail, the biggest airplane in the world lifted off, on its own power, and flew. Howard Hughes had proven his point, and he'd proven it to the whole world. And then he never flew it again. Not once. Not ever. That 30-some seconds over Long Beach Harbor is the entire flying career of the Spruce Goose. Every hour that airplane logged in the air, you could measure it with a sweep of a second hand. But don't think for one minute that Hughes just walked away and let it rot. This is the part that tells you everything about the man. He kept that airplane in a climate-controlled hangar for the rest of his life. He kept a crew on it, full-time. Men who came to work every day to maintain an airplane that was never going to fly, keeping the engines preserved, keeping the wood dry, keeping her ready. It's said he spent $1 million a year for decades to keep her perfect, just in case. Ready for a flight that was never going to come, that went on until Hughes died in 1976, $1 million a year to preserve a dream that flew for less than a minute. Now here's where the story could have gone dark, and for a while it looked like it would. With Hughes gone, nobody quite knew what to do with the thing. You can't exactly stick a 320-foot wooden airplane in the corner of a museum. For years, she sat under a giant dome down in Long Beach, right next to the ocean liner Queen Mary, a tourist attraction. And that was fine for a while, but attractions come and go, and eventually the outfit running it wanted the space back. The airplane needed a home, a real one. And there was serious talk that if nobody stepped up, the greatest wooden airplane ever built might just be broken apart. The people who stepped up were a family named Smith up in Oregon, building a museum in the little town of McMinnville in the Willamette Valley wine country, the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum, and they said, "We'll take her." Now here's a problem for you. You've agreed to take delivery of an airplane the size of a city block and it's sitting 1,000 miles away, and it does not come apart easy and it certainly is not going to fly to you.
So in 1993, they took her apart, carefully. The wings, the tail, the hull, the engines broke the whole airplane down into big sections. And they moved her north, partly by barge up the Pacific coast and up the Columbia River, and partly overland on trucks, big, slow, oversized loads crawling through the countryside. And folks came out to the roadside to watch pieces of the biggest airplane in the world go rolling past their farms. It took months. And then in McMinnville, a small army of volunteers, a lot of them old-timers who knew airplanes, spent years, years putting her back together, board by board, rib by rib. And here's the part I love, they built the museum around her, that great glass and steel building in McMinnville. They raised it up over the airplane. The Spruce Goose didn't move into a museum. The museum grew up over the top of the Spruce Goose, like a barn built around a tree that was already too big to move. I've stood under that wing, friends, and I'm telling you, no photograph prepares you for it. You walk in the door and your brain just refuses the scale of it for a second. That wing goes on and on, out over your head, out toward walls that seem too far away. You can walk inside the hull, you can look up into 8 engine nacelles, each prop taller than 3 men standing on each other's shoulders. And you stand there and you think about a shipbuilder's wartime idea, and a stubborn genius, and a Senate hearing, and 30 seconds over Long Beach Harbor in November of 47, and you understand that you're looking at all of it at once, held in the air over your head by wood and glue, and the sheer force of one man's refusal to be told no.
So why does she matter? A one-flight airplane, a wartime idea that showed up after the war was over. On paper, a failure. I'll tell you why she matters. Because every airplane you've ever loved started as somebody's impossible idea. Somebody looked at the water and the wood and the size of it and said, "That can't be done," and Howard Hughes, whatever else you want to say about the man, and there's plenty, Howard Hughes put it in the air anyway. One time, just to prove that the word impossible is smaller than most people think. That's the whole spirit of this thing we do. That's why a pilot stands under that wing and gets a little quiet. And she matters because a family in Oregon and a crew of volunteers decided she was worth saving. Decided that a thing built by hand, by boat builders and cabinet makers turned aircraft men, was worth barging up a river and hauling down a highway and rebuilding board by board so that you and I and our grandkids could walk under it. That's what a museum really is, when it's done right. It's a bunch of people refusing to let the story end. Back when Avgez was cheap and airspace was free, we built things because we wanted to see if they could be built. The Spruce Goose is the biggest, most stubborn, most beautiful piece of that spirit anybody ever nailed together, and she's sitting right now under a glass roof in McMinnville, Oregon, waiting for you to come stand under her wing. My thanks today to the folks at the Evergreen Aviation and Space Museum who keep her, and to the records of those old Senate hearings and the reporters who were there on the water in 1947, who left us the account of the day the wooden airplane flew. You can find us at radiohangar.com, and if you ever get out to the Willamette Valley, do yourself a favor. Go look up. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the wood dry and the story alive. I'll see you next time.